Hi, welcome to the Geek Whisperers. This is Amy Lewis.
And I'm John Mark Troyer.
And this is Matthew Brender.
And we're kicking things off fast and furious this week because we have an amazing high-energy guest, Rakesh Barania. I want to let you introduce yourselves. Or did I say your name wrong even?
It's Barania, and I won't hold it against you.
Thank you. Well, go. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so I am a network engineer with a team at Cisco Systems called Tactical Operations. We are sort of technology first responders for Cisco, so we will go into a disaster situation, whether it's an earthquake or a hurricane or some sort of a man-made event, and provide emergency communications for first responders, critical infrastructure, continuity of government, and similar kind of organizations. But beyond that, I actually happen to also be the coordinator for social media for our team. So we have a pretty broad social media presence on Facebook and Twitter and SlideShare and a couple other venues. And I'm the one who's primarily responsible for keeping that content going.
So that's a lot. I should say full admission, and we'll have some pictures up on the blog post that goes with this podcast. I got to go tour the truck that is kind of home base for Rakesh whenever they go into the field. And it's pretty amazing. And the concept of engineers in Kevlar is pretty intriguing. Engineers in Kevlar plus trying to figure out how to navigate social waters in a time of crisis, we thought was particularly interesting.
So Rakesh, we're talking about real crisis, like things where there's a great event, a tragic event happening in the world, as opposed to something like what I normally hear as a crisis, like a competitor tweeted something we didn't want to hear publicly. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, yes, and that's absolutely correct. So our team responds to things like Hurricane Sandy, or you know, as we're talking, you know, we're currently on deployment in West Texas, so we have been responding and supporting public safety and community restoration down there after that fertilizer plant exploded. So we kind of live on a 4-hour call out basis, so we perpetually have our go bags packed and are ready to go. So it really is a really interesting hybrid of both being a technologist but also a first responder.
Rakesh, I'm kind of interested, how does Cisco look at this program? Is this part of their community contribution? Obviously, you're not out there trying to sell wireless IP, you know, routers or anything like that.
That's correct. Our team was created in the aftermath of September 11th, primarily to do high-risk networking, so places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and that was how the team got started. So we did a lot of military support in the early days of the team, which is how we wound up with the name Tactical Operations. But around 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit, there was a need for a lot of emergency response technology in the affected region around the Gulf Coast. And as part of that, one of the things that happened was Cisco said, hey, we need to get our technology expertise out into the field to support all these different organizations that were affected by the storm. The problem is that no matter how smart of a techie you are, unless you're trained and supported for the crisis environment, which is a pretty unique environment, you sometimes create more problems than you solve. And so coming out of Hurricane Katrina, Cisco, as part of its after action, said, well, how do we go ahead and do this in a repeatable way in the future? And so that's really where the program pivoted away from military support to humanitarian aid. So assisting public safety and government and NGOs, non-government organizations, and other similar humanitarian activities. So while we still do work with the military, it is primarily on what they call the HADR, Humanitarian Assistance Disaster Relief side. And that's been a really interesting pivot. And, you know, we can talk a little bit more about how social media impacts this, because, you know, 2005 was one pivot point, but certainly 2010 in Haiti was another pivot point.
I actually had a reason for asking, and that's because it seems like what you're doing, notwithstanding the social linkage, which we'll be talking about most of the hour, is actually ideal for Cisco. And I think so many times we talk to social media practitioners or marketing programs people, and they're like, it'd be nice if, wow, what's the formula for this? You know, give me a guidebook, give me a checklist. And the answer is, well, to do innovative work, whether you are a quote-unquote creative or not, you have to do something that is unique and genuine to your organization and where you are and what you do. You know, I mean, EMC cannot airlift disc arrays into Texas, you know, in the wake of a disaster, right? It doesn't make any sense. But they can go over to the Vatican and help them digitize, you know, priceless libraries of works of art and libraries. And so this seems like very native to kind of Cisco and its mission in the world and in technology.
I agree with that. There are a number of companies out there that do some sort of crisis response. Google and Microsoft are two that come to mind, as well as Ericsson. So there's three for you. But of the four companies, including Cisco into that list, each one of those four companies does it somewhat differently, and it reflects the company's own core strengths and objectives and the corporate culture. But what I can say, because I know the people on all those different teams, is that the passion of the people on the different teams is absolutely shared. And we actually all collaborate with each other when we're in the field and responding to a particular incident. And if it's something where the Microsoft team is better suited to taking on a particular task, we will have no problems tossing that over to them or vice versa. It's certainly, you know, playing to your strength and playing to something that you're actually – it's a core competency of the organization.
So that actually raises another question, which is sort of interesting because, like you said, play to the core competency, but at the same time, this isn't a marketing opportunity. So how you talk about these things in a time of crisis is very important, which leads us into the idea of disaster and crisis response and how to use social media responsibly in times like that. One of the things I thought was interesting, Rakesh, is I know that you've had media training and some training around this and that your team has established protocols. Could you give us a little background on that?
Yeah, sure. So my background is not really in media. So I was sort of an accidental social media user. I came to this because of family.
Rakesh, we all are. We all are, really.
So it's not like something I gravitated towards. But what happened was that since this is a part of Cisco's corporate social responsibility, there was a need to actually start explaining what we're doing and how we're doing it. And the truth of the matter is that when you look at the current generation of folks, the millennial generation of employees that are coming into the workforce, as well as responsiveness to stockholders, I think people demand more from their companies, their corporations that they're affiliated with than what they might have done 20 years ago. It wasn't just enough to return a quarterly profit, and it's really interesting because when we're actually on a disaster scene, we actually have to abide by what's known as the public information officer of that incident. So there's a couple of different media protocols we have to follow. One is the general sort of corporate Cisco media protocol that governs things like how we discuss things related to marketing and business activities and things that are not related to an emergency. But the second thing that we had to craft on our team that was really unique was a crisis mode. In other words, when we go on a deployment to a Hurricane Sandy or to Haiti or to Japan or to Texas, how do we message appropriately that respects a couple of different contradictory motives? One is that we want to be seen as a company as being responsive to a need. But secondly, we don't want to be seen as exploiting the crisis and people's personal tragedies for a business reason. We don't want to be seen as trying to make hay out of this. And that's a very easy area for organizations to get tripped up in. I mean, this is an area that's full of minefields, right? So one false tweet or one false Facebook posting can destroy your credibility with the organizations you're trying to support, with the public that's following you, and just really complicate things. So we had to really think about how to craft that. And you know, sometimes it was trial and error. But I think we've gotten to the point now where through a number of different deployments, we've actually created something that works well for us and what we do.
Yeah, Rakesh, I'm actually, what I'm imagining here is what's so fascinating to our audience and honestly myself as well about what you're doing is that everything you were just saying, the concern about that one tweet or that one thing or losing a relationship because you say that one thing wrong, it's simpler in my job. But with yours, I feel like your position puts social media to an extreme. And it's interesting because when you focus on the extremes of some things like social media usage, you can actually find a lot of truths about the way the platform is used universally.
You know, I think one of the basic premises that we start off with is that the premise that the conversation on social media either happens with or without you, right? But you can't stop the conversation from happening. And this is something that when I work with our customers, the organizations, which are primarily government, it's been a really interesting challenge to get them to understand that reality. I think that recent events in the last year or so have certainly really driven that home, that when a crisis happens, conversation happens online, right? That social media conversation is going to happen. It's going to happen rapidly. It's going to happen with some mixture of fact, some mixture of rumor, and some mixture of something in between. And as an organization, whether it's Cisco or FEMA or the United Nations or any of these different organizations, the choices that they have, that we have, are either to engage in that conversation and be a part of that stream or not. But you can't arbitrarily say that conversation's not going to happen. And that's been a really interesting cultural change from the old way of responding to emergencies that a lot of people have been dealing with for the last several decades. The idea of one-way information flow from inside the emergency to the outside world has radically changed in just the last few years, and that's something that we're all trying to come to grips with.
And the same is true for organizations that we work in. So let's really dig into the social media side of your job. How is social media utilized by you and your team in peacetime and in crisis?
So I think that there are two main elements to what we do for social media. The first element is monitoring. So typically, we monitor in near real time things like the trending keywords on Twitter and some other things along those lines, because what we've found is that social media really is kind of the heartbeat of a lot of the planet, and that we can detect an incident in progress on social media pretty rapidly before traditional media will report it. So,
and sometimes, just to jump in and share one little story that you told me, sometimes I think you said that your listening even indicated earthquakes, you know, spreading places before they happened.
Yeah, there's actually there's a great comic, an XKCD comic, which indicates the speed of tweets actually going faster than the speed of an earthquake, so that once you get past about 150 kilometers away from the epicenter, the tweets and messages on the internet will actually arrive to people before the actual waves of the earthquake will. And the comic predated the earthquake on the East Coast a couple of years ago, that 5.0 earthquake, which was significant for the East Coast, but for those of us in California, was no big deal. But it turns out that we could actually see that happening, because the earthquake waves on the East Coast actually were preceded by tweets about that same earthquake, you know, a few seconds ahead of time. So it's one of those things where life really does imitate art. You know, the way that we look at it, any one person on Twitter saying OMG quake, that's not really information. But if 5,000 people in Los Angeles within a few seconds say OMG quake or the equivalent thereof, that's a signal. That's a tripwire for us. And it says to us something of significance may have just happened. Let's start attuning to that. And we actually have a duty officer, an operations coordinator for our team that always has that responsibility 24/7 of saying, oh, hey, look, something may have happened. Let's investigate it. And then if necessary, let's start activating the rest of the team for a possible response. But so that's the first aspect, is this kind of alerting, proactive notification. The second part of that is to get our story out. So getting our story out may be talking about the state of social media. And so I'm personally involved in a social media community on Twitter called SMEM, and that stands for Social Media and Emergency Management. And this is a very, very active social media practitioner community for people in the emergency management community. And so engaging in those conversations are certainly part of the job, because we're trying to evangelize the use and help those organizations transition from the old world to the new. And that's kind of sort of for lack of a better term, the peacetime job. And that's where we see things like Twitter postings or posts from various blogs about an interesting paper that might have come out about how you do networks in an emergency, things along those lines. Not unto all, you know, it's very similar to the other kinds of social media that other Cisco social media venues do. So they'll post out messages and things along those lines. And then the last aspect of that second portion is the crisis mode. When a disaster happens and we decide that we're going to be involved and we are typically invited into an incident, we don't self-deploy into a disaster. So somebody is asking for our help. At that point, our social media goes into a different sort of mode where we defer all of the non-crisis related content. So I actually have, as I'm sitting here, a bunch of content that as soon as our team is demobilized from this current incident that they're on, I have a bunch of stuff that I'd like to get out. But right now, because we are looking at social media from either engagement with the public on what we're doing or to get information out there, we defer all of the non-crisis related social media until afterwards. So there's some pretty significant rules that we follow, and they're not because someone told them to us, but we find that they are the most effective.
That does bring up one application to our daily lives, and actually, I just wanted to say, I kind of feel like I am a mall cop, and Rakesh, you are an actual soldier, in terms of what I have to deal with every day.
Exactly what I'm feeling too, John.
But it's fascinating because it's such a different world, but still using all the same levers that we have. So we're recording this in late April, and a lot of stuff has gone on this past month, not only in Texas but in Boston and elsewhere. You spoke about kind of dialing it back, being sensitive to when you're on the ground and kind of dialing it back. We don't really want to get into global conversation about media and crowdsourcing and that sort of stuff in this podcast. But there was one aspect that we've kind of struggled with here. We had to put our heads around, which is, as a commercial venture, when do you flick off the switch? When do you turn off the switch? When do you dial up your commercial speech and when do you dial it back? And in the case of Boston, we did dial it back what we were doing online. I don't know, Amy, Matt, is that relevant to this conversation as well? And did you guys have that same discussion in your organizations?
Absolutely. Rakesh and I are both at Cisco, and we do have a policy. They asked us to pull anything, any auto tweets. And I just from personal experience, I ran a number of websites during 9/11, and even pre sort of the hardcore social media age, I was in New York. My laptop was on the other side of the World Trade Center from me. I couldn't get to it, and I still got dinged for not putting something up immediately about the crisis on our web pages. So I think in that case, I was, again, in New York and unable to get to it because of the crisis at hand. So I think that the lesson I learned from that long term is definitely err on the side of caution. So Cisco does have the policy of be sensitive, don't be tone deaf to what's around. And I'm curious, Matt, what the policy at EMC is, and then Rakesh sort of sharing with us how they manage.
Sure. Yeah. It's very much agreed that we're sensitive to whatever situation's going on. There's a be honest, be forthright sort of policy in place and an emergency response process that really involves turn off all auto tweeting capabilities and tools that we utilize throughout the day, and just make sure you're paying attention to your community and engaging with them, personally, with that professional taste that we always need to have with our owned accounts. But just saying like, hey, we're feeling for Boston, we're feeling for West Texas, and paying attention to what's going on. If we can help at all, tweet us, and just go from that sort of content push mode that we can be in sometimes as marketers and just go into straight community listening and support.
There's really two challenges there, though. One, in a big organization, there's no big red button. We do not have one social media fabric underlying all of our efforts. We might eventually get there. Many of our things actually go through one control pane, but we like a network. We have a bunch of different networks here, so there is no big red button. So you have to send out multiple messages, and it's not all, you can't always catch everything. That's one thing. And obviously there's people, you know, personal tweets and people using Buffer and things like that. And it's hard to stop everything. So that's one problem. The other problem is, again, for a multinational corporation, there's that dial of how parochial are you? How global are you? There is disasters going on all over the world. Is there some sort of a graph that is people affected by, you know, how far away it is from your global headquarters? You know, how do you choose what earthquake to say you're sorry for?
Those are really good points, because we've had to deal with all of them. Amy's point about being tone deaf is absolutely important to us. What you'll see, for example, on our Facebook page for our team is that if there is an incident that occurs, it's a little bit odd for us, because a lot of times our audience is expecting us to be like parachuting in like that instant with routers strapped to our backs. I mean, so there's an expectation of responsiveness on our part, even if the situation is developing and unfolding and changing rapidly. And so typically what we do is we'll put out a message saying that, you know, we're aware of this incident and that we're following it. We're monitoring that situation. So at that point, we're not even committed to responding to something. So we're just saying, yes, we're aware of something. And that demonstrates two things. One is our awareness of it, so that we're actually seen as plugged into what's going on. So that's really important that we be seen as relevant and plugged into an emerging situation and yet not committed to doing anything about it just yet. So that's something that we tackle pretty regularly. The second question that came up just now, though, was what earthquake do you say you're sorry for? There's no real good answer that I have about that. But what I can say is that When we sit here and think about what we're going to respond to, there's two things. One is, what is the chatter on social media? So if there's a lot of people talking about a particular event, there's a lot of interest in it. And I'm kind of interest driven. So that's the first thing, is it interest driven? And are there, and then the second thing, and maybe this is actually the primary thing, is we are on the side of posting and upholding public safety. So we encourage people to be safe. So a couple of weeks ago, there was an earthquake off the Santa Cruz Islands in the South Pacific. And there was the threat of a tsunami, and that a small tsunami, like a 3-foot tsunami, was generated. Now, the most relevant threatened area was actually New Zealand and sort of the northern coast of Australia and stuff. But whether that was actually going to be a real threat or not wasn't going to be known for up to 2 hours. So in that case, it was a very large earthquake. It was like an 8-point-something, I think. But what we did was we went out and said, we're aware of this earthquake. We are aware that a tsunami warning is in effect. And we encourage you to tune into your local authorities for the latest information. So in that, we've said, we're plugged in, we're aware of the incident, and we're encouraging public safety. But you'll notice at that point, we haven't necessarily said Cisco's doing anything about this, right? We haven't committed the company to a course of action, because it's still an emerging situation, and whether we have to do something or not about it is still unknown.
Rakesh, you know what you did there just wonderfully? You move from one incredibly powerful area to another. You didn't use the word, but you move from awareness to setting expectation. And if there's anything that is relevant to anyone on social media and involving people and programs like we all do, it's setting the right expectation, but also first showing that you're even aware that an expectation is expected.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. I think that, I'm sure that you guys have talked about this in previous discussions, but I think one of the tendencies is to use social media too much like a press release mechanism. In other words, it's just another one-way mechanism for conversation.
Another
but
push.
It's not really a conversation at that point, right? It's just a sounding board. We have to gauge it based on where our audience is. And our audience is really interesting, because if you look at sort of the breakdown of who follows us and who's talking to us, it's usually about 1/3 the emergency management community, who may or may not know who Cisco is in the tech industry. It's about another 1/3 Cisco employees who are interested in what CSR we're doing. And then the third are sort of IT people, people who understand data centers and routers and switches and storage area networks and the cloud and things along those lines. So it's a really interesting mix of individuals that follow us. And we have to be careful in our messaging to keep all of that in mind about who we're actually talking to and to be willing to have those conversations with them.
Wow. And Rakesh, I know you mentioned that your organization's been around for some time now, but how long have you had a Twitter account, and do you have any other social properties that you use to monitor and engage on?
I think we started building a Twitter and Facebook presence for our team back in, I think, early 2009. And a lot of that was really interesting because our team used to do so much work with the military and in places that were somewhat hostile, that kind of work really didn't lend itself to social media. You wanted to consider things like force protection and operational security, and you didn't want to put your people at risk because you were broadcasting things about what they were doing. And so what happened was, as we started getting more and more into humanitarian space, we realized that instead of secrecy, what was absolutely required from a CSR and humanitarian standpoint was transparency. And so there was really kind of a cultural change that we had to undergo before we really started diving headlong into social media. But I can tell you that our social media engagement has been absolutely brilliant. And I think that one of the things that helped us was building the partnerships within Cisco's crisis communications and the other folks who were responsible for that external messaging really early on to make sure that we had a level of trust and autonomy in what we could say. Because, you know, maybe this is just my biased opinion, but I think that our social media messaging is very much, it's aligned with the broader Cisco messaging, but in a sense, it's very different, right? We're kind of like the network fire department.
Yeah. And for folks that don't know, CSR is corporate social responsibility, yes?
Yes, that's the broader program by which we engage in the communities that we operate in.
It's kind of an industry term, actually. I just Googled it, frankly. That's interesting, Rakesh, because I was just about to ask the acceptance level of management. Here at VMware, you know, we have a foundation, we have matching programs, we have programs that let people take time off to go volunteer, and all that sort of stuff that's baked into our culture. And we've talked about publicizing it, but people are very wary of over patting ourselves on the back. So we actually don't talk about it at all. And then also there's that just you're at a very high risk reward ratio. Actually, they're just very high risk when you guys tweet. We've never really had this question, but it is kind of a 101 social media concern, which is that all of us tweet without much approval. But often a 101 question is, you know, do you have to get approval for your tweets? Do people review them or things like that? And my assumption is no. But, I mean, can you talk a little bit more about the acceptance and comfort level process? And I assume it was a process over time.
Yeah, it was a process. And actually, you bring up a very good point about culture because, again, you don't want to be seen as exploiting somebody else's tragedy, which I think is to your point, right, about how a large corporation is perceived in the middle of a disaster or somebody's crisis, some community's crisis. Initially, our vehicles, the Nerve and the other vehicles that we have, didn't even have a Cisco logo on them. So, the picture of the big black truck that we have, for example, that says Cisco and it says emergency communications on there. Well, that signage is relatively new because we didn't want to be seen as marketing in somebody's emergency. So we carried that principle all the way out, not just to our social media, but all the way out into the field with us, where we would totally underplay who we are and what we were doing out there. We would just kind of do the right thing and know that that was enough. And then in 2010, there was a big gas pipeline explosion in San Bruno, California, just south of San Francisco. And our team was requested by Cal Fire, the fire department out there, that was the lead agency for that response. And we came out there, and we were out there for, I think, 3 days supporting crisis communications for that emergency. And then an interesting thing happened. We learned afterwards that other government agencies were taking credit for having the vehicle out there. They were saying that this is our truck, this is our asset. And what we were told by a fire chief afterwards was, you guys really need to have some logos on there so that you guys can get credit that is appropriate for what you're doing. And so that really had us come back and say, well, what do we do? What do we do? You know, and there's some really nice marketing graphics that Cisco has. And you see some of the other vehicles that Cisco has for marketing and business development purposes. And it was very obvious from the get-go that we couldn't go down that road. So it just says emergency communications on the side of the vehicles, because that's something that any cop or any soldier will understand and let through the yellow ticker tape, right? So we need to get past that yellow line that keeps the public out of an emergency, and we don't want to be looked like we're doing marketing. So it's very simple and very direct, we think. So how does that play into social media? Well, again, it was kind of an evolution. I have pretty broad authority to tweet or to post pictures or imagery or what have you. But we obviously realized that it needed to be tasteful, and that the last thing we wanted to be seen as disaster tourists, right? People who were just running around in a crisis zone, taking pictures of all the devastation. And, you know, we've been to Haiti, right? So our team was out there in the middle, and there were unburied bodies in the middle of that rubble. And so we're not going to post stuff that's going to be further traumatic to a community. So we worked with our corporate crisis communications team, and this is the element of Cisco's marketing communications that gets engaged in things like potentially negative events. So things like security vulnerability disclosures and other sort of potentially negative or risky press. And we came up to them and we said, well, look, this is the program that we have. And what I wanted to have done is I still wanted to have the authority to tweet and post with a great deal of autonomy, but it's really about building a level of trust with the other elements, with my management chain, with our crisis communications team, and with our legal folks. And so there was really a long conversation about, well, what's this? And so for a while, I was actually running every tweet by the crisis communications people saying, this is what I'd like to say. Is this okay? And they'd say yes or no. And by this trial and error, we actually sort of created what I call an envelope. So the SMEP, the Social Media Engagement Protocol, which I think is going to be available to listeners, is basically the result of this discussion. And what it says is, you know, these are our social principles. These are our goals in what we're trying to do. And this is kind of the envelope we play in. So as long as we're kind of following, I don't want to say playbook, because playbook sounds entirely too scripted, but as long as we're staying within the envelope of what all of the stakeholders has agreed is appropriate and acceptable, then I have a great deal of autonomy in it. But if it's questionable, then I have to run it up the flagpole a little bit. But typically, if it's questionable, I'm probably not going to post it anyway. I mean, you know, the number one thing that we have to worry about is the safety of our people, which is something that I think a lot of social media organizations don't necessarily have to consider in a large tech company. So you'll notice that one of our first principles is what we call OPSEC, or force protection. So sometimes we go into places that are considered hazardous, whether the security on the ground is not the best. So if we're talking about things that might make our people kidnapping targets or worse, yeah, we're not going to put that out on social media, right? So we have to consider things from that perspective. We're always going to be considering things from the on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground perspective first.
So Rakesh, I have to jump in and ask you, because I just keep thinking, like John and Matt said, it is hard not to feel like a mall cop, but what lessons do you take in some ways from that you can apply to your real life? Does it make you sort of hypersensitive about things like Foursquare? Or because we get asked questions all the time about people feeling uncomfortable sharing too much on social media, and it's of course not even in this league, but what general lessons have you learned about good use of social media from some of the extreme, from the real dangers that you've lived and worked in?
So I think you know, when it comes to personal social media, I think you have to be very aware about what you're getting yourself into. And from my perspective, I personally kind of get around to the idea that a certain element of privacy is dead. And if you're not okay with that, then social media is not the place for you, right? So you have to come to an understanding that every time I post to Facebook or post to Twitter, some digital breadcrumb is being thrown out there into the ether that I may or may not have complete control over. Facebook, for example, is infamous for changing its privacy policies every 6 months or so, right? And so there, but for the grace of Zuckerberg, go we. You have to consider that. So if I'm going into a place where I am concerned about my safety or concerned about the safety of people around me, I'm just not going to use it. I'm just going to, you know, stay offline, stay quiet. Until I have a certain level of comfort that, okay, that's fine, and that's an appropriate and acceptable risk. But I think that part of engaging in social media and part of engaging in these conversations is ceding a certain element of control and being comfortable with that and understanding that that is just the reality of the world that we live in now. And if you choose to engage in social media generally, and there's a lot of reasons to do so, that you just kind of have to accept that.
There are a lot of politicians out there that could have used that advice from you at some point, Rakesh. But Amy, I'm actually going to flip this on you. So you know what Rakesh does. We've been listening to him go into the wonderful details of what he does for his job at Cisco. How is what Rakesh is doing affect your job, and how does it influence the way you interact through social?
Oh, that's a great question. I have found it to be incredibly inspiring, just in a number of things, because we all have we've talked about different communities that we're participating in. So one of the, in some of my back and forth banter with Rakesh, I got to see a little bit of what's going on, like you said, in the hashtag SMEM community, and so seeing some of that subcommunity looking into a world that I don't know anything about is really, really interesting. And I guess, Rakesh, I got to know you a little bit during the wildfires, because some of the tweets came through. Somebody retweeted something. I don't even know how, but you know, Cisco is such a large company. There's a risk we could work there our whole careers and not know each other personally. So it's another case of we got to know each other on Twitter. So there's thing one, you know, by engagement with social media, I got to meet somebody at Cisco doing some pretty amazing things. And then on a trip to RTP, we actually got to meet in person. Again, another one of our Geek Whisperers tips of, you know, stay active. And then when you have the opportunity, meet in real life. And we did sort of talk shop about the protocol, because a lot of the questions that we wrestle with, exactly the kinds of questions we've been asking, when do you turn it off? How do you use it? What's too much? Like you said, this is an amazing test case where the consequences are pretty real. So, you know, we talk about gamification in the workplace and trying to incent behaviors. This is at a whole different scale. Not bad to get the lessons, you know, from the extreme and bring them back into your day to day.
Agreed.
So that's been a big part of it. Even thinking about information like when you take a picture, something would be in the background. It's made me more aware of the pictures I take.
That very I good
publish
point.
Publish out through you know, a more corporate or more public channel. I agree with Rakesh. I think you are, once you have to cede a certain level of privacy. And I'll say on the inverse, and again, I don't know if I should share this trade secret, but I will. When I'm, you know, I'm a woman in business, I often have to travel alone. And when I do, my phone is always in my hand. And I actually use Foursquare for inverse stalking, where I check in so that if anybody's going to axe murder me, they will, at least somebody will know what my last location was. So when I go from point to point, when you talk about ceding privacy, and again, listening to this conversation and thinking about it from the other perspective, I've used social media to alert the free earth as much as I can where I am. And so if I go silent, people actually check on me because I'm notoriously chatty on the interwebs.
We would miss you. Yeah.
A lot.
And there would be at least 15 packets of fame that would be lost into the ether. It's true.
And all that bacon. All that bacon.
Yeah, there'd be a lot more pigs on the earth if Amy disappeared.
But and again, a little bit down a rat hole there, but it's been really interesting sort of sitting back and watching how Rakesh and the team are using the different platforms. So we've talked a lot about Twitter, but watching how they report on Facebook and seeing how the reports come out, not necessarily in real time, but in ways that are meaningful, what information is shared. It's just for me, it's been an instructive case study. And I know we're not going to go too far into specific tragedies, et cetera. But I am curious, Rakesh, and also through this back to the rest of the team, about where you think we are in our maturity as a nation, as a culture. We've had a lot of cases where social media in the last few years has changed the way news was heard, reported, engaged with. The Arab Spring is one of the more classic examples. We know that the way the Boston PD engaged in terms of the incident in Boston is going to be very much talked about. I'm curious if we've got any predictions or thoughts about where we're going from here.
I think what we have here is a situation where social media and crowdsourcing and the whole sort of network effect is an incredible amplifier. We saw this for the first time during 2010's Haiti earthquake, where people on the other side of the world, it used to be that if you saw something on television, you would go to the Red Cross and give $20 or something along those lines. And that was the extent of something that, you know, somebody who is not directly affected by a situation is essentially a spectator. Unless they're, you know, they have some direct effect of that emergency. So they would just go to the Red Cross, donate $20, and that would be it. But a lot of people said, you know, a lot of people would sit there and say, well, that doesn't satisfy my emotional need to do something with a capital D and a capital S about this emergency. And so one of the things that social media has done is it's given people many, many, many outlets, whether you're technical or non-technical, to actually get engaged into a developing situation. Now, to your point, though, Amy, I think that the rules of the road are not yet really valid. And so I'm just going to highlight one community from last week, which was Reddit, right? So, and what you saw from that messaging there was not, we are going to crowdsource and try and help the FBI, but it was explicitly stated, we, the community of people who are involved in this activity, want to try and beat the FBI to naming a suspect. And I think that that's where that kind of crowdsourcing can go off the reservation. And we saw how that went sideways for that community. But at the same time, you know, all of our institutions, whether they're government, whether they're private sector, whether they're academic, all of our institutions really do have to evolve to take all of this into account, and to understand that this two-way conversation is just kind of expected of everyone now. And from the FBI's perspective, instead of just emailing photographs, we really need to figure out a way to enable things like the crowdsourcing of information by well-meaning individuals and yet being able to filter out erroneous or bogus or perhaps malicious information. So I think that we're certainly on an evolutionary process here. I think that our technology has perhaps outstripped our philosophy and our abilities to assure integrity.
I think that's a pretty amazing thing to think about. And as we talk about personal responsibility going forward, and I know our podcast last week talked a lot about learning to think more, you know, being more aware of it, that we don't want to scare anybody off, but it comes with responsibility. You have to, these are trust relationships we're taking on, and it comes with responsibility. And the idea that there is an off-ramp is not really an option for a company. Individuals can participate at the level they feel comfortable with, but I really, I think that's a really important point we're bringing up, that as a corporation, it will happen with or without you, and you just have to decide.
Yeah, I think the worst moment for any company is when there is a situation, whether it's a dissatisfied customer or it is some negative event where they try reaching you via social media and the avenues are closed or no one's listening or someone hasn't tweeted from that account in 9 months or things along those lines. And all of a sudden, that thing suddenly snowballs. And we've seen this time and again in many, many different situations. And then the flip side is, you know, if you're responsive, even if it's not necessarily always good news, but if you're responsive, you wind up generating that closer customer relationship, that closer relationship with the audience out there, whoever your audience happens to be, I think there's a great risk in avoiding it, and I think there's a great benefit to embracing it. You just got to kind of understand that there's some rules of the road, and to try and you know, operate in a way that is there with integrity.
Yeah, and I believe the documentation you're providing is really a wonderful framework, even for the mall cop situations many of us will find ourselves in. That just like one of your principles, like don't be afraid to humanize yourself and the team. I mean, that's something that is just expected. There's this level of transparency online and just a very earnest conversation that's taking place. And when companies do that well, it creates a vibrant relationship based on trust, as opposed to something where you have to just tote this line that leaves people feeling like they're being pushed out of a situation. But before I let you jump back into it, Rakesh, I just had to ask, we've had a theme over a few weeks of going into the metrics of social and how we justify our jobs to some degree. And how in the world are you measured? I mean, what is your measurement of success? And, you know, if you have one, of failure, is this something where Cisco's just going to do this no matter what? So anything is a thumbs up, or are you held to higher expectations?
So I think for Cisco, it's really interesting. So if I go back to the 90s, before we had voice over IP and IT shops, there was always the network shop, the IT shop, and the PBX world. And then voice over IP happened and forced that kind of convergence, that transition in the marketplace for telephony. Similarly, when you look at public safety and emergency communications, that transition is basically happening now. People are going from a traditional world, which was kind of really oriented around the radio that they wore around their belt, to more IP communications for things like mapping and email and everything else that we've been talking about. As an organization, as a company, Cisco recognizes that there's an ongoing need to provide essentially high-touch technical support in the middle of a crisis. So I think that our function is really, it really exists because of necessity, right? So Cisco did not wake up one day and say, oh, well, let's get some really shiny black trucks and some flashing lights on these things and go into a disaster. But it was really because our customers needed things like emergency network restoration. They needed, people like search and rescue teams, if they couldn't get the maps they needed, you know, obviously their missions would be degraded. And we all want to make sure that we can support those kind of missions. So from a metric standpoint, social media is not really something that factors into our metrics. So we're looking at if we deployed, was the customer successful in continuing or enhancing their mission, and did we do that in a safe and effective manner? That's really where our bottom line comes in, and that's our that's what we're graded on. We do get engaged on things like consulting engagements, so customers will come up to us. We really like your technology. We'd like to implement that for our government, for our municipality. And in that case, any sort of incremental revenue we bring into the company is kind of just bonus, but it's not expected. We don't have any dollar value associated to what we do that we're expected to bring in. So there's no, we are not expected to be a revenue generating organization. That expectation is not on us because, and the really cool thing about that, by the way, is it allows us to be subject matter experts. So a lot of our Cisco government sales teams will bring us in on a customer account and say, you know, this product that we're trying to sell you, you don't have to listen to me, the sales guy, about whether it works or not. Let me bring in the tactical operations team who actually deployed this on these different incidents, and they'll tell you what really works and what really doesn't work about it. So we get to really be sort of an honest broker between the traditional sales and marketing organizations and some of these government NGO humanitarian organizations that may be somewhat skeptical about this transition to IP. So in that sense, we actually enhance the business of the company, but at a more tactical day-to-day level, we're not expected to actually bring in any revenue.
So any other questions? I know we're about at the top of the hour.
I would just say that that's a wonderful model for your team. And I love the way I'm thinking of it, basically, is that you have your charter, you have what you're going to be executing upon, and the way you're going to interact with these other businesses as that broker, as a consultant. And what I love about this is that social media is this thing that's arisen, and you've seen the value in it, and you've adopted it as another way to engage. And it hasn't just been engagement with your audience, but it's also been, you know, as much as we want to make sure you keep that focus on relief and what you're doing with the people there and messaging properly, it is a marketing tool for you in the sense of it's showing who your team is and what they're doing and where they are. And it's a wonderful opportunity to use something that's both enabling communication and also enabling loyalty by showing who you are.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that the expectation of our relationships with large companies now is very different, and that we hear it a lot of time from our customers saying, you know, even if I never need you guys, I'm glad you're there.
That is a great note to end on, I think. So some pretty amazing insights and advice from the, I feel like we should rename our podcast from the Geek Whisperers to the Mall Cop Wannabes. Pretty impressive stuff.
No way, we're definitely whispering to a hell of a geek tonight. That's no doubt. Yeah.
That is the truth. So really appreciate your time, Rakesh.
Hey, no worries. Hey, thanks a lot for the opportunity.
And where would you like people to find you online?
So my personal Twitter account is Densayer, D-E-N-S-A-E-R. But I think the better one is on Twitter at Cisco TacOps, all one word. And on Facebook at facebook.com/cisco.tacops. And all of those links are also in the social media engagement protocol that will be up there with the podcast.
Well, thanks a bunch. And for this week, the Geek Whisperers are signing off. So we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as Jay Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.